As Chris mentioned, I work for the Center for Plant Conservation as the Vice President of Science and Conservation, but I also have a dual position as the Director of Plant Conservation for San Diego Zoo Global. And so I'm going to be able to wear both of those hats during this presentation, and hopefully that will make sense to you in a moment. Every time I hear numbers presented about how many plants there are or how much endangerment there are, you have to realize that it depends on who you're looking at. So I have a slightly different statistic than the one that Hector presented to you earlier. This is a state of the world's plants by Kew Botanic Gardens. They indicate that there are estimated 391,000 vascular plant species, and one in five of those are threatened with extinction. In the U.S., we believe there are about 29% of the U.S. flora that's considered at risk of extinction. That's around 4,000 to 4,400 species, depending on how many species you know to exist at the time that you have this measure. And there are emerging impacts of climate change that bode unprecedented risk and rates of endangerment. The Center for Plant Conservation is a network of over 40 participating institutions that hold collectively over a third of the globally rare species in North America and 70% of the federally listed plant species. They hold those in either seed banks or in living plant collections in their gardens. The organization is a science-based research organization that promotes best practices for plant conservation, and we advocate for plants for their value for humankind. We have a website that's called, you could find at saveplants.org, and I encourage you to look into it. On that website, we have plant profiles of the endangered plants in our national collection. Here's an example of a plant, Astragalus bibulatus, that is one that is held at Missouri Botanic Garden. They've done extensive research on this species. They have seeds in the seed bank, but they also have done ecological studies in habitat to try to understand why the populations are threatened, and they've been trying to build up populations in the wild through plant reintroductions. The Center for Plant Conservation has produced guidelines in these Island Press publications, and they include guidelines about not only plant reintroductions, but conserving rare plants in ex situ situations in our botanical gardens, and also looking at managed relocation. An example of these best practice guidelines, and I have to give credit to Chris Walters for helping with the most recent revision, is to underlie how our garden conservationists should be storing their seeds ex situ. And we start off by indicating that conservation collections' real reason is to support species survival and reduce its extinction risk in the wild. It's not the same as an herbarium collection to have a seed collection. In order for a conservation collection to have maximum value, it has to have records of provenance, its maternal lines differentiated, and diverse genetic representation. There is a global strategy for plant conservation for botanic gardens, and there's also a North American strategy. And in those strategies, there's a goal that by 2020, 75% of threatened native plant species will be maintained as ex situ collections. So I'd like to show you how the Center for Plant Conservation Network Gardens are working towards that goal. And I wanted just to point out that for some gardens, they're lucky enough to have great biodiversity within a 50-mile radius of the botanic garden. But for others, they have to go hundreds of miles in order to make these collections. And I'll show you examples of ones that I've been involved with. So the diversity of plant species in the U.S. Is represented somewhat by this NatureServe rarity-weighted richness model. This particular model includes both animal and plant species, but where you see the red blotches, you see high levels of both species richness and endangerment. So I have had the pleasure and onus, really, of working in two of these red areas recently. I was working down in Miami, Florida at my Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden, and now I'm over in Southern California. In California, there are over 8,000 species listed for the state. Within my county, 2,700 of those species, 370 are listed as species of concern. NatureServe, so again, depending on who you're listening to, the numbers are going to shift, but NatureServe lists 83 of these as globally rare. These are some photographs of some of those species. They're threatened by habitat loss, invasive species encroachment, changing climate, and increasing fire frequency. That's really the case around the world. Everywhere, those are the major threats that cause endangerment to plant populations. And in California, we're expected to lose 1 in 4 of those species over time, which would be very sad, but not on my watch is what I say. So we're really fortunate in San Diego County that we have a San Diego Association of Governments that does many things, including mapping the populations of the rare plants in the county. And so all of these little pixels that you see here, the squares, represent these federally listed endangered plants. This is just San Diego County. So that's an example where we have that much work to do within a 50-mile radius of our botanic garden. But also there are examples where our network gardens have to travel long distances, and here's a Hawaiian example of rappelling down cliffs in order to get to the rare plant populations. Mountaintops are great places for rare plant diversity. Here's a team in Puerto Rico that went out recently to collect some rare plants in the highest points of Puerto Rico. So my title was that there are unique challenges to rare plant collection and curation, and I was thinking of this group as being more familiar with agricultural species. And so I know that as a child I got used to planting the bean seeds that I got in the package and put them, just give them a little bit of water and bam, all of them germinate. Not really the case with wild seeds, and certainly not with rare seeds. They've got unique challenges because they may grow in remote locations, so they're hard to get to. Those mountaintops in Puerto Rico are day-long hikes up to get to where they occur. When you get to them, they have very small populations. many of the seeds are not viable. And when you get them back into the garden, they may be very difficult to grow. In Hawaii, they've got particularly dramatic challenges. And we have 4 botanic gardens that are part of the Center for Plant Conservation. And we're hoping to get the Plant Extinction Prevention Program also to come on board. In Hawaii, over half of the Hawaiian plants are at risk of extinction. They have 238 species that have fewer than 50 extant individuals. And that is when they came up with this measure, that was extant anywhere. Extant in ex situ, in botanic gardens, or in the wild. And so this plant extinction prevention program began working on a genetic safety net. And I'll tell you one of their success stories at the end of my talk, because they have been working now for over 20 years, and they've been making great progress to help prevent extinction of plants in Hawaii. Their statement here is that Hawaii has lost more plant species within the last 200 years than in the past 2,000 years. But under the Plant Extinction Prevention Program, they've actually been preventing extinction. Each of our CPC participating institutions does similar kinds of work, in that they bring in seeds to a seed bank. Some of the institutions are lucky enough to have a seed bank on their own property. This is the Straw Bale Building, which is the seed bank at San Diego Zoo Global. And it's a facility that's been in place for over a decade. And we bring in seeds and process them and test them for long-term storage. Here are some, just so that we can see that they're actually real plants that are associated with the work. These are our target species that we've received grant funding from this organization called San Diego Association of Governments. Many of these are vernal pool species. And we do laboratory trials to get initial germination rates, and then the idea is to test those over time, test their ability to withstand desiccation and freezing that may impact their storage capability. So here's some examples of laboratory tests that have identified germination requirements, and now I'm shifting gears, and this particular species is one that's done by that grows in South Florida, one that I worked on in Miami, and Chris and I worked on this together. These are results actually that were done at her laboratory. One of the things that she found was that these are a hard-seeded legume, and that a factor that had the highest germination was to give them a heat treatment. They're growing in pine rocklands in South Florida, and that's a fire-adapted system. So it was really nice to see these kinds of factors that mimic the natural conditions for germination. Here's an example of one of those high elevation Puerto Rican species. This is the grass Aristida chasei. And you'll notice that germination is here, if you just look at this line, less than 5% germination. If you were just to take seeds that you collected from the plants in the wild without looking at whether they're viable or not, and you just put them down, you'll see that only 5% of them germinate. If you go through painstaking, under the microscope, testing each seed, which is something that Hector and his friend suggested. We did this with this plant because we were frustrated with this low germination percent. you'll find that actually desiccation improves germination. And these seeds are capable of withstanding desiccation and freezing, and so they can, at least for a short term, be stored or using orthodox methods. When we test South Florida species that are growing in pine rocklands, what we find is that about 68% of those species are capable of at least some short-term storage in with desiccation and freezing. Similar results have been found for Hawaiian species. Actually, they've had higher rates than that in some of the Hawaiian species. But as Chris will probably tell you, the length of time for that storage may vary across the taxa. For those species that cannot withstand drying and desiccation, there are other alternatives that we use for holding them ex situ and keeping them safeguarded against something happening to them in the wild. And that includes micropropagation. In Hawaii, they've got over 20,000 plants of 167 rare and endangered native species in facilities in micropropagation. But you can also use liquid nitrogen for storage, and there are some taxa that we've been working with Chris to store, including fern species and orchids that are in the facility at Fort Collins. And all of those species are South Florida species that are depicted. So trying to understand propagation requirements is the next step, because as we saw, germination is one thing, but getting something to emerge and establish is another thing. And if our idea is to store these species in order to have them safeguarded against something in the wild, we really want to be able to get them back out into the wild. So we need to understand what they require to propagate and how to keep them alive for in containers and also ultimately in the field. Many of these species have seeds that are so tiny. This Dudleya here is one that the seeds are dust size, and so similarly what you were mentioning, that tracking seedlings in the field is difficult because they're so minute you would have to be crawling around on your hands and knees in order to see them. You can almost have to do that in order to see the adult plants. So the intention of these is to get them back out into the wild, and the Center for Plant Conservation Gardens use seeds for research, for seed bulking, and reintroduction to the wild to build the resiliency of the wild populations. This is an example of the key tree cactus reintroduction that was done by Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden 2 years ago. I understand with the recent hurricanes that went through that a lot of the plants were knocked down, but the reintroduced population was not wiped out entirely. The problem is that once plants get very stressed from these catastrophic events, no telling what is going to happen to them. So they're going to be tracking them over time. So, as promised, the success story from Hawaii with very rare plants. So, Cyania marxii was known from 8 individuals in the South Kona Forest Reserve on Hawaii Island. And through surveys, 4 more individuals were found, and one of the major threats in Hawaii, actually, in addition to those threats that I mentioned in California, are invasive mammals that prey on the plants. So fencing is one of the big things that's used to protect rare plants in Hawaii. They fenced the founders. They cross-pollinated two populations, and they created a three-acre fenced outplanting site, and they outplanted 200 plants that were generated from ex situ collections. And as of November 2016, these three new populations were established. So you can see what they look like. And here's the guys getting ready to outplant them. So with that, I'd like to thank my past and present teams and collaborators on this research, and I'll be happy to take any of your questions. Thanks. Yes?
In one of your drafts, you applied heat to mixed organisms. What is the temperature and for how long?
The temperature was 60 C for 5 minutes.
5 hours.
5 hours. She did that.
60 C.
Yeah.
How come did it denaturate the heat at 60 degrees?
It's easy to dry and hot. It's moving. And I was worried about that, but I think terrible. We've repeated it now. We've gone up to 80.
Really? Wow.
And they've got very thin little membranes that are keeping the water out. It's pretty remarkable. Any other questions? Yes.
So I remember we talked about the Aristida work that you're doing in Puerto Rico. So you guys are finding high proportions of MVCs with that species. Has any work been done looking at the genetic diversity of the population of that Puerto Rican Aristida?
I don't believe so.
You guys deal with a small population?
They're extremely small populations, yeah.
Because that's neat, because most of the remnant population would wire the maps in the south, and the shadows of what they used to be. I'm just wondering if there's some genetic way to the low proportional biases, or if there's some other factor that could be driving the embryo abortion.
I'm not sure. One of the things that I've recommended is because the Fish and Wildlife is concerned about bolstering the wild populations, I've suggested that they increase the planting densities so that the plants aren't so far separated, and maybe that might help with pollen receipt.
Yeah, the southeastern population, the plant density, I think, is 3 to 4 plants per meter squared.
Yep.
The plants are close together. It's wind pollinated, and you're still seeing so.
Yeah.
I'm not criticizing that idea. I'm just wondering what the mechanisms might be. There's a lot of plants that produce MVCs regardless, but trying to figure out why I think it's important, especially for the small populations.
Yeah. Right. I would say that the densities of these plants is maybe, you know, around 10 in an area the size of this room. So they could use some more, but who knows whether that will work. Yeah. Yes?
I don't work with wild species, but I'm working with forage, like alfalfa, clovers, and grasses. For at least for clovers and grasses, sometimes it's very difficult that they germinate. So before we plant in the field, we have to plant them in petri dishes, you know, petri dishes with a piece of paper and liquid water. Sometimes we have to treat it with acid. Sometimes we have to sand it, you know, sandpaper. My point that I want to do, an observation that I learned with this, is when I put in a petri dish, let's say 5 to 20 seeds or 30 seeds, put it water and following day or 2 days I came, and the professor used to have a lot of experience with Dr. Kim in the University of Florida. Depending on how old the seed is, they produce like a yellow substance. we have to transfer them for a new filter paper because they say they are releasing chemicals and they compete each other. And I noticed that when I do that, then those at the end germinate are germinating, so I have to feel, oh, it's compete paper. I don't know if that happened also in wild species, like they compete, they introduce it from chemicals, even if we can the same
I did not observe that. I did observe that the more seeds that were in the petri dish, the less water uptake per seed, so it slowed down germination rates the more. So, and I think that had to do with water uptake, not with allelopathy.
It might be secondary infection from the growth, so the transfer to use.
Oh.
Yeah. Thanks for that suggestion. Any other questions?
Mine was more operational. How do you prioritize who you're going to help and when and how?
Yeah. It's been a lot based on opportunity. In California right now, there are so many, a lot of people ask that question, and I think that there are so many rare species that just go for what you can at the moment, what you have funding to do. And once we get to the luxury of, oh, I've only got 10 species and I've got money for one, let's worry about that then. That's mine, but I have colleagues that are generating models, algorithms on phenology and et cetera in order to prioritize. But I think that we've got enough that we can just go out there and get them. My group collected 30 seed accessions this past year, and they tell me that out of the 370 so, they have another 50 species that would be new to our seed bank. But if they were to capture the breadth of the distribution of the species, they think that they could be doing that for another decade with the existing manpower. Yeah. We are working on it. We have the National Collection Database, and we have now a data scientist working with us at Global, and that's our dream, is to have that accessible for the public to be able to see who's working on what. We're also doing that internally in California. There's a group called the California Plant Rescue, which includes Center for Plant Conservation Institutions as well as some others, and there's an online resource where you can see their collections. But our goal is to get that for the nation. Yeah.
Wonderful, thank you. If there are other questions, I'm sure George will be available after.